You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. This week we present the first of several recordings done at DragonCon 2014 in Atlanta. With this episode, we're going to present a panel from Sunday morning in the American Science Fiction Classics room, where Andrew Gaska and I talked about Space 1999. Andrew is the writer and creative force behind a recent revival of Space 1999 as graphic novels. And so he and I discussed the show in general and also what he and his company are trying to do with the property in their current licensed state. Andrew's two Space 1999 graphic novels that are out so far include Aftershock and Awe and To Everything That Was. So, without further ado, here is the Space 1999 panel from DragonCon 2014.
Okay, so we both love Space 99. Clearly you love Space 1999 yes, because sir. How did you end up getting involved in doing actually new material for
Space 1999?
I formed my company Blam Ventures back in 2005. Basically what we are is, I call us a guerrilla design studio, but what we're known in the business is as a book packager. And what that means is we put together a project, get it like 95% done, and find a publisher to put it out through. So I decided I wanted to chase down some licenses that had inspired me in my childhood and pretty much give something back to them. And Space 1999 was on that list. And it was extremely difficult to get ITV to even want to touch
it. Right.
They for some reason have done hardly anything with it.
They're notorious about being stingy with license. Yeah.
And it was when I first brought it to them, they shot it down, and then they had a change in licensing department, and I brought it to them again, and they shot it down, and then they had a freelance licensor who came in and contacted me and said, I've seen all these proposals that you've done, and I don't know why they're not doing this, so let's sign you up before I leave.
Awesome. There you go.
So that's pretty much how we got the license. And, of course, then when the new people took over, they immediately shut down our project. I had to fly out to England and do presentations to them, and then they were like, oh, okay, and they greenlit it again.
Good
and
grief.
So it's very strange the way they've treated the property. I don't think that they understand that if they kept feeding it a little bit all along, then it could grow and grow and become the next big blockbuster movie that they want it to be. You know?
Do we know why they're being this way? I mean, do they think that it will actually make a property more valuable to not do anything with it and let people out there know that it exists anymore?
I think they're embarrassed by the title. Okay, which is something that, you know, because obviously the year 1999 came about and there was no space.
That's putting it mildly. But, of course, we still have the moon, too, so it is kind of a bad news, good news
right,
kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Okay?
The far future of 1999 wasn't far enough.
World's still intact, but no eagles, so, you know.
You know, and that's one of the things I tried to address in my first graphic novel, Aftershock and Awe. Mm-hmm. I wanted to find a way to make this relevant, and yet, you know, because there's so much retro coolness in Space 1999, people who haven't been exposed to it yet, looking at it like, oh, this is actually pretty neat, and it's so bizarre with the comlocks and all, you know, the way the technology went. So how can you explain that the world took this different path. And for me, the perfect reason for that would be that JFK was never assassinated. So in the world of Space 1999, JFK lived, and the moon program continued, and technology took a different course of action.
That's so cool. Yeah. If I were to do like a cover blurb for your first book, I would just say aftershock and awesome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's really good. I got the hardcover for Christmas last year, and I was very thrilled. So tell us all, we're going to get into the show itself, but since we have you here, right, I want to talk a little bit about sort of your vision for Space 1999, where you're taking it, because you really, I mean, you know, currently there are some novels occasionally coming out that are essentially small press or almost
and
POD.
They're great stories. The Powys Media books are very nice, but they have they're following a different track than I am.
Right.
I had actually talked to them about, you know, trying to make a consistent universe, and then we both had separate plans for where things were going. So one of the things that I'm trying to do in my books is mention that there are all these different realities.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in each one of the realities, the moon has blasted out of orbit for a reason.
It's fascinating, too, because in the original novels, I think E.C. Tubb did a couple. And in that one, it was that the moon, like you say, the moon is gone, basically, in all of them, but in different ways and different versions. Like in that one, the moon had just, the explosions caused it to vibrate into another dimension, and when it quit vibrating, it came back.
Right.
So there's so many different ways that you can do.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this while we're talking about the actual setup, the moon and everything. When I talk about this show with my friends who were, you know, kids like me when it was on, you know, in the mid-70s, and they watched it, but it has a reputation. I've never understood this. I want to see if you guys agree. It has a reputation. People will say, oh, yeah, the moon gets blasted out of orbit. That's so unrealistic. It's unbelievable. I'm like, okay, so a magical starship that flies 50,000 times the speed of light around the galaxy and beams people to planets with a half-human, half-alien first officer, that could happen tomorrow. But a show where they have basically Huey helicopters with rockets on the actual moon that does currently exist, as far as I know, last night it was still up there, that's completely unbelievable. What do you say to people that try to act like this show is the most unbelievable of the sci-fi TV shows?
Well, I mean,
I don't get it.
It all comes down... What was it? Was it Asimov who?
Asimov thrilled with it.
He started the ball rolling. He had complained about the science involved in that. But the thing is that, like, that's what is amazing about metaphysics today. It's like there are, just because we don't know how something can happen doesn't mean that it can't happen. And that's one of the things I tried to explain in the book. I give a bunch of different reasons why. How could this happen? You know, but in the end, it doesn't matter how it happened. It mattered that it did happen, and somehow they survived. Because that's what they would be concerned about. You know, one of the things I love about Space 1999 is the idea of the mysterious unknown force,
the MUF.
Yes, which you know, the guiding hand of God, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That is involved in this, and that's one of the things that I've been doing with the series, is that we're trying to make it clear that there is a purpose for all this, and if we get to go to the completion, which is there are 10 graphic novels planned out, this is just the first two. If we do get to go to completion, there's a beginning, middle, and end to all this, so there will be a payoff.
Mankind has a destiny in the stars is basically where they were always going with that.
Yeah.
At least in the first season. We'll get to that in a minute. I can't help but wonder what Isaac Asimov thought of Battlestar Galactica in 1978. If he thought Space 1999 was just completely unbelievable with the science, what did he think of... I mean, I love Galactica, but come on. I mean, 1999 at least is more, you know, trying to be sort of scientific.
He probably gave up after Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think maybe part of the problem is that Space 1999, it's basically 2001 A Space Odyssey, the show. I mean, that's basically what it is, right? And it may be that it has such trappings of realism in a lot of ways that it makes the scientific inaccuracies more obvious than a show that just says, screw it, this is rock and roll, you know, this is space opera, we're not even pretending to be. Is that...
Yeah, I think that's what people don't realize when they're watching it, they've raised the bar. And again, we're not talking about the second season.
Right.
But I mean, they used to say transporters were impossible, and now they're you know, they transformed a particle from like 13 feet from one side room to another.
Did a fly get in there with it?
No, unfortunately not. We don't have any light flies.
All right.
But yes, I mean, you know, technology, the cell phones we carry, communicators. I mean, technology changes, and our understanding of the universe changes. So, just because we don't understand it doesn't mean that.
No, I always say that I thought at this point in my life we would have colonies on Mars and the moon and be doing everything we see on Space 1999. We don't have any of that, but I can watch a movie on my telephone in the bathroom. So there's a trade-off, you know. Technology goes where there's a demand, and I guess that's what the demand was for. Who knew? All right, well, let's talk about the show a little bit. The show got started. Man, I don't know where Anthony Taylor is this weekend, because we desperately need his encyclopedic knowledge too. He's toured all the sets and talked to all the people and everything, and written books about it too.
He was supposed to be on this too.
I don't know. I don't know if he's even at DragonCon this year. He was here last year. We did a panel a year or two ago on Space 1999, and he knows a lot about it. He writes for some of the magazines. But anyway, we do fine. The show was a British production, right? Let's talk about the background. It's a British production, but they wanted the American market. So it was like a British show produced specifically to go to syndicated TV shows in America, right? I mean, the idea was, it's not, well, I don't, did they originally pitch it to a network in America, or did they just always say, we'll try to sell it, the same, kind of the way Babylon 5 was, we'll sell it to be plugged in odd spots here and there on American local TV stations?
Yeah, they couldn't get any major channel to back it, so they decided that they were going to just, you know, saturate the small channels across.
Straight to syndication, yeah. One of the first to do that, and Sir Lou Grade and ITC?
It was ITC. Now they're ITV.
Okay. I didn't realize that was the same. No wonder I was confused. Okay. Yeah. So they backed it, and of course, in order to reach an American market, even though everybody else on the show is British, you've got to get some American stars. And there was Mission Impossible wrapping up, and so they go and get
Barbara Bain and Martin Landau.
Yeah. Right. So you've got this American couple headlining the cast, and you know, it was funny, a friend of mine, I've used this line here before, so some of you may have heard it, but a friend of mine was pointing out, they said, you know, when they did the restoration of Space 1999 onto Blu-ray, it made it so clear that you could actually see the wires that hold up Martin Landau and Barbara Bain. not that she's stiff or anything. So it gets into syndication, and lots of TV stations bought it. I mean, I think it did fairly well to start with, but maybe it was a little slower, maybe than they were hoping. It was a little more cerebral and not as, you know, action packed in the first season.
Right, and one of the problems also is that because it was small channels, they would switch around the schedule. In fact, people who were actually fans of it couldn't find the show.
That sounds familiar. As a Babylon 5 fan.
You know. So, it was decided that the show was a little ponderous, and then they wanted to liven it up with some action.
Yeah, so if you think about the first season, and we can critique, but just kind of as while we're doing this overview, if you think about the first season, you're after the two leads, who weren't the most dynamic action heroes ever, let's be fair. I mean, they're awesome, we love them, but they weren't, you know. Your third lead was the professor, an older cerebral guy. So you got to go all the way down to Alan Carter, really, to find the action man. And what a shock. He became like the most popular character. Right. They were surprised, I guess, that Alan, the dashing, heroic, brash pilot guy, he's the most popular character? We never saw that coming. Well, how could they not have thought that that was going to, you know?
When they made the switch to the second season, they were planning on getting rid of everyone except for Landau and Bain, and it was only because of his popularity that they kept him on,
yeah. But that put them in a strange position in season two that as we transitioned over. Oh, and one other thing about season one is, you know, season one, it did have some, you know, wonderful stories in it, Johnny Byrne and others, and Penfold, but there was a whole lot of them getting bailed out by the mysterious unknown force, mm-hmm. them having to convince, right, the universe to not be mean to them. They were more reactive in a way than proactive, and American audiences were not thrilled by that. So, you know, and a lot of, like I said, like I was joking before we started, a lot of the episodes ended with the main characters gazing out the window longingly as the piano music plays and, you know, speculating about metaphysics. And you could just see Americans all over the United States going at that, right? I mean, it's awesome and it's inspiring, but the average TV viewers, they don't know if they had remote controls back then, but they're clicking the right to the next channel. So season two, what do they do to liven things up, in at least in their minds?
Producers. They hire the guy who killed Star Trek.
Freeburg.
Yeah, Freddie Freeburger, right? Yeah, Freddie Freeburger. The guy responsible for season three of classic Star Trek, which, you know, it's his wonderful plot lines like Spock's brain are considered one of the reasons why that show was canceled. They hire him to revamp the show, and of course it becomes the Monster of the Week adventure show.
So let's see, what are some of the things that they do? A thing that they did that was not a bad idea was bring in Maya, because she's kind of an action-y character. It's basically Manimal in space. I don't know how Joe Crow, and this is his second favorite show. She really is Manimal in space with monsters. That's pretty cool, but they got rid of Professor Bergman to do it, and he was beloved, and that just kind of cut some of the heart and soul out of it. They bring in Tony Verdeschi. You know why they brought Tony in?
No more.
Because the one country the show was doing awesome ratings in was Italy. And they wanted a dashing Italian-looking guy to be on there because it was Cosmos 1999 in Italy. And it was doing really well there. And in fact, the guy that did the Eagle blueprints that were big a few years ago, is Baldessari, is Italian.
Right, right.
So it's still a big thing in Italy. Kind of like Jerry Lewis in France, Space 1999 in Italy. There you go. And so they bring that in. They bring Tony in. But now you've got Alan and Tony kind of in almost a competition for who's the subordinate, cool, dashing, good-looking guy, you know. Tony or Alan? Let's see Tony. Let's see Alan. There you go. Poor Tony. Poor Tony. Well, he got Maya, so it worked out. Alan never got anybody, I don't guess. We never really saw. But yeah, they bring in the Monster of the Week so that Maya can fight it.
Or become it.
They brought in the jackets, which, jackets, yes or no? Jackets, no jackets. Yeah, kind of, yeah. We lost main mission and went to command center, which looked like a first grade classroom.
Right.
Now, you know the reason why they quit doing main mission for season two?
That it was too big and...
It was expensive. It took like an hour or two to set up the lights for that giant box of a set. They would have to just, all the actors be standing around drawing pay for nothing while they got all the lights just right and filmed, you know, 5 minutes of stuff and then take all the lights down and move it around again. So they're like, we need to have most of the talky action in a smaller room. And so wasn't there some explanation that something blew up main mission, they had to relocate to their backup room?
That's in one of the novels from Powys.
Okay.
Basically what I did in my graphic novels was that they were entering an area of space that had strange radiations that they weren't sure how it was going to affect them, so they went underground.
Underground, right.
And the jackets were because they had to conserve power, so the temperature was a little colder.
I'm going to say, yeah, there you go. So, since you mentioned that, let me ask you this. I'm trying to remember, and it's been a while since I read it. Clearly, you're jumping off of season one. How much does season two figure into your storyline?
The next book is planned to take place 30 years afterwards, and it includes everything. But in this book, to everything that was, what we started off with was the art from the comics that came out in the 70s, some of the British comics, mm-hmm. some of the Charlton comics. We colorized it, and basically we were forced to make certain changes because Martin Landau and Barbara Bain own the rights to their likeness. Okay, so we were forced to go in and do some art changes. And when that was happening, I started to realize that a lot of these stories were written very generically, so that you could because back then the writers, they did not have access to the show on videotape or necessarily any or had seen it at all.
Right.
So there was a lot of mistakes about the way the characters interact with each other. So I thought, well, there's no reason why Koenig should be calling Victor Dr. Bergman, you know,
things like that. Right,
so,
so
I started to make little changes like that, and then I realized I could actually, while preserving the stories that were intended as if as their own little stories, breathe Space 1999 continuity into this. Mm-hmm. So that's when we did that. Basically, we set up Maya and everything in this because there were comics with Maya in it. So this is a new creature, which is also an old creature. If that makes
any
sense,
right? That's what I mean.
So we fully intend to incorporate season two. In the first book, Aftershock and Awe, I put Tony as a security guard outside of main mission. Mm-hmm. You know, the lowly security guard. He's not chief of security yet. Mm-hmm. So you see what he was doing during Breakaway, things like that.
Right.
So, you know, we try to make a continuity that makes sense. And that strange radiation comment I made before, when Victor brings it up to Koenig that we're going to be going through this area of space before Victor disappears, it's suggested in my book that the effects it could have on the human mind would that they'd be a little drunk, and so that reality may not be exactly as they're seeing it. So you can think of season two as this bizarre psychedelic trip version of what was really happening then.
So in season three, Alan gets out of the shower and none of it ever happened, right? I like it. Okay, yeah, you know, that's it's worth noting from what you mentioned there that, you know, we take for granted now that shows have showrunners and that the scripts are so planned out in advance. So something like Babylon 5 or the new Battlestar Galactica, you know, among many others, you know, they're planned out. There's continuity that's very strong. Things carry over from one to the other. But back then, and I remember as a kid being disappointed, I could tell that there was no continuity control, right? I mean, even as a kid, you're like, but no, they did this last time. How come it's this way now? I'm smarter than whoever's writing this show, and I'm 10. You know, that's why I kind of felt. And so, it's right. You could get to like the ninth episode of a show, and the characters act like they're just meeting each other because the person that's writing that script has never seen anything else. Those were the bad old days in some ways, you know.
Yeah, it was very fly by night, and it was very who's paying attention?
There was a lot of disregard for the audience in a lot of ways. I'll just give them this stuff, and they'll like it. It's got spaceships, you know.
Most of the channels that played the show didn't even play them in the order that they were given by the studio. So you know, each episode was a beginning, middle, and end of a story, and that's it.
And the local stations would even cut pieces out if they couldn't fit enough ads in.
Yep.
I mean, you know, I watched some of the episodes on DVD when they first came out again back about, 12 years ago when the A&E sets came out. Mm-hmm. And I bought that. And I remember thinking, I don't remember that scene. You know, there was stuff I was noticing. Oh, this episode had an ending? Because they would sometimes just chop the last how many ever minutes off the end. They wouldn't even have the courtesy of finding the most inconsequential scene in the middle. They just lop off the end and stick an ad there. Mm-hmm. And you'd never know how it ended. And I would curse Channel 42 in Birmingham or whatever it was back then for... if I'd even known they were doing it, I didn't even know. So, all right. So, do we have anybody here that wants to argue that they may be afraid to now? That wants to argue that season two is the one they like better? We won't make fun, promise much. So, everybody here is a season one. Season one. Okay.
I saw first season two a little bit because I understood it better.
Okay.
You know, I was young,
sure.
A little kid then too, and some of the stuff that happened in season one, it probably went right over my head.
No, yeah,
because it was all so ethereal and that kind of thing.
It was 2001.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That's another problem for the time when it came out. It's like, who was this show for? Everyone thought it was for kids, but it really was for adults. So a lot of adults never found it, which hurt the ratings. And then, you know, then they just really made it for kids for the second season. And there's some good second season episodes. There's no question of that. And you know, even the person, anyone who even hates season one, season two completely loves Maya because she's amazing.
Yeah, I think my reaction when I started seeing season two back in the day when I was a kid, my reaction was, well, I like that they're jazzing it up a little bit, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I'm missing the things they took away. That was kind of, I was really missing Professor Bergman because I really liked him. Yeah. He was a, you know, it was neat that that there were people that were running the place, but they had somebody even more. He was like the Gandalf, you know, of the base. He's the wise elder statesman you can go to when even you in command don't know exactly what to do.
My friend used to describe him as a warm and cuddly Captain Picard.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to meet him at a convention a couple of years before he passed away, and he was walking down the hall with a helper who was kind of helping him walk mm-hmm. along, and I just ran up to him and hugged him, and I was like, I love you, baby. It's great. And he was so nice. He just was so thrilled by that, so I'm glad I got a chance to do that. Never met the others, but yeah. Let me see. Are the Eagles not the coolest spacecraft ever in history?
Yes, they are.
I always thought so. What's your take on the Eagles and how people still, even people remember them even beyond the rest of the show?
It's so iconic. Yeah. And the best thing about it is that it just feels like a natural extension of what we do with our space program in the first place.
Exactly.
The obviously, you know, if we tried to bring that into an atmosphere, it'd probably fall apart. But
it looks like something NASA could make.
Well, that's the thing. As a space vehicle, it would totally function without any bizarre technology. It's practical. The fact that it's modular. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need this thing in space. Just, you know, don't try to take it into an atmosphere.
Yeah, it's a workhorse. I mean, it really is designed to do labor. It's like those industrial helicopters with the big, you know, with the big open space mm-hmm. in the legs. That's what it always made me think of. So.
That's what it makes noise when it takes off.
Oh, it made those awesome noises. Yeah. Oh, man, I used to love that as a kid. I've done that noise 8 billion times. All right, well, we're coming up on our halfway point. Let's see what you guys want to ask the panel. Yes, sir.
So what did the stars think of it as they were doing it? Have you read interviews with Martin Landau? Were they embarrassed by it?
I've never seen anything where they were embarrassed.
No, I went to the Space 1999 convention 2 years ago, and Martin Landau was there, and he loved the first season. He was so frustrated what was going on with the second season. He talked about how he'd have arguments with Freddie, and one of the things he actually said was that he went to Freddie with a script. He's like, Koenig would never say this. And he's like, who says Koenig would ever say this? It's like, but the audience watches, and they know I don't act like this. It's like, no one's paying attention.
See, this is exactly what I'm saying. There's this disregard for the audience that shows today don't dare have.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They understand the audiences are sophisticated. I think that audiences aren't any more sophisticated today than they used to be. It's just that in today's competitive world, they've almost been forced to respect the audience more if they want to stay on the air in any form, you know, and build a following. Because it took television a while to realize that loyalty of viewers is a good thing, right? They used to think of loyalty of viewers almost as, oh, great, now we're going to get much more Trekkie mail letters, you know.
Yeah.
But now they realize, no, these people are generally in our demographic we want to sell things to. They're loyal.
Loyalty of viewers
smart.
Is what keeps them on the air nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely.
So. This gentleman had a question.
Yeah, I was just curious. When is the last time a Space 1999 rerun was shown on American TV?
Because
I don't ever remember seeing
it. In the 90s, it was on Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah.
But I would say that was probably the last time.
I don't think it's been on since 1999. I think that was a good point that we kind of zipped past that I wanted to mention, was that, you can argue that it is hurt by the title. And there is an effort to make, what was it, Space 2099? There's been some talk. But you were saying the other day that you thought it was probably not.
It's been in pre-production hell forever, and my graphic novel series is currently on hold because of that. Which is very strange to me also that they want, they're afraid it's going to like interfere with what they're doing.
No.
But I feel like it's not going to happen. There was interest a few years ago. Bryan Singer was interested in doing something with it. But then the before Superman Returns, and then Superman sort of distracted him from that, and he never went back to it. The guy who's working on it now is, I can't remember his name, but it's the same guy who revamped V. So it's a complete reimagining.
Well, sometimes, you know, that can work, and sometimes it doesn't. It's their own fault about the 1999, because this was them trying to be 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about Breakaway, Moon blasting out of orbit aside, Breakaway is 2001: A Space Odyssey, right down to the moon base. Yeah. It opens with a guy with a commander on a shuttle going to the base on the moon. There's a virus, right? There's all the. It's like they sat down with a 2001 script and just scratched out Star Baby, whatever, and put explosion, and then there you go, you know. So. Because the whole virus thing makes no sense in Breakaway.
I was always frustrated as you know we were getting closer to the year 1999 and then surpassing it that they had chosen such an early date. But when I was at that Space 99 convention and Martin Landau spoke, I understood why they did it, because he said he thought it was really important that it was a date that was within the kids who were watching this show's lifetime.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Because this way they could see this is what the future will be, and I could be part of this. I could be part of the space program, you know, and that was really important to him. So I see where they were going with it.
Yeah, because like Star Trek and Babylon 5 are both in the 23rd century, and you have to say, you have to kind of think, well, it's heartwarming to know that maybe we'll be like that someday, 200 years after I'm dead.
Yeah.
But, you know, when 2001 was advertised, one of the taglines was putting today's man in tomorrow's machines today. And that really hits on exactly what you're saying, which is today's kid in this future today.
Yeah,
absolutely. So they really, yes, sir, right.
I want to mention a couple of things. On the catacombs side, you can see where Martin Landau made notations on his scripts, saying things like, Conan's a schmuck in this episode.
Who was this one?
Conan.
Oh, Conan, yeah. Right.
And also, maybe one reason it was popular in Italy is because they had Italian actors as guest actors in like 6 episodes in the first season.
Yeah, they had a lot of Italian.
Right. And they got, they were able to get Brian Blessed on there, which is always a plus on any TV show. But, yeah.
Well, season one.
Yeah, he was, well, I know he was Maya's dad, right? And he was also the
Death of the Dominion.
Yeah, it was Death of the Dominion. Yep. He was the guy on the ice planet. Right. Yeah. That's right.
Yes.
Not really a question, just a comment. I hated Maya with a flaming passion. I thought she was the worst thing they did season two.
Okay.
She did take the show.
I didn't
in a
mean
very
to say everybody.
She did take it in a very different direction. So if you liked what was going on before, she was a sharp veer off in a different direction.
She ruined what I liked about the show, and I thought she was the most disillusioned. I thought she was a desperate piece of cheesecake to add ratings. That's all.
If she'd still had her costume from the first season, it would have been even more.
And I was 12, so it's not like this was like...
Catherine Schell went on to run a hotel in France, I think, for a while. So she
She lives in France.
She made out pretty well.
What I liked about her was I thought she brought a sort of innocence to it. And if they were still doing the intelligence storylines they were doing the first season, and they kept Victor around, having that innocence there could have been a good reflection of humanity, just like Spock is a good reflection of humanity. But she could have been very different. Instead, they did try to make her more Spock-like as it went along. But I think Catherine Schell is a great actress, and I just thought that there was a lot of potential with that character. So, the whole shape-changing thing is a little bizarre. Not to be scandalous or anything, but one of the things that we're doing in the stories is that, you know, when she shape-changes, her clothes don't change with her. So if she becomes a tiger, when she comes back to human form, she, you know, makes sure she's discreet when she does it.
No unstable molecules in the universe.
No.
Yes, sir, in the green.
Well, one of the things about the shape-changing is, and they do this in a lot of shows, they don't ever seem to shape-change into the right thing. The episode where she was the bird, and she was captured in that net.
Yep.
Okay, change into something that's smaller than a bird and fall out.
Sometimes she could change directly from one form to another, and sometimes she had to change back into her
back to human. Yeah, This is what we mean by that you were 10 and felt like you were smarter than the writers sometimes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Anything else? Anybody else? Yes?
Best episode, worst episode, and why?
Ah. Andrew, what do you think?
My favorite episode... just blanked. I know which one it is. It's the one with the... It's called Black Sun. One where they go into the Black Sun.
I do like Black Sun.
It's called Black Sun.
I do like Black Sun. And yet almost nothing happens in it.
Yeah, but it so tells you so much about these people.
Right.
I mean, that's why I named the second book To Everything That Was, because, you know, when they're sure they're going to die, Koenig says to Victor, you know, to everything that could have been, and Victor says to everything that was.
Oh, yeah.
And that the instance is, you know, bringing back the old art, the old comics. That's why I named this book that. But there's so much heart, and I just feel like it's the show done right. Mm-hmm. If you're going to follow the 2001 vibe, that's the show done right.
Oh, yes.
Your favorite?
Oh, I agree. I do like Black Sun, I agree. I mean, it's just strange that, I mean, if you're Fred Freeberger, you have to look at Black Sun and go, oh, how is this on the air, right? Because almost nothing happens. The only proactive thing they do in that entire episode is build a force field that they know will not work.
And you know what? When I first saw that episode...
That's not a criticism.
Right. But when I first saw that episode and they're building the force field, I was like, I was like, BS. This is so stupid. Why are they even making this? This is the worst science they've ever done. And then when they have that little conversation about how they know it's not going to work, but they built it for morale.
For morale.
I was like, oh, that's amazing.
Absolutely.
That's totally amazing.
And that's why I think it's one of my favorite. That and just getting Koenig and Bergman to sit there and have that conversation is so cool. You know, I guess... I do have a soft spot for the two-parter in season two. If you're going to do a season two episode, it's cool to have one with lots and lots of monsters and nobody can see them but Koenig. I mean, I have people criticize me for saying that, but I really like with the Bringers of Wonder 1 and 2. I really like that one, the Super Swift and Tony's brother and everything. That's about as good as season two gets, honestly. That's not bad. I mean,
what you're saying about scientific inaccuracies, that you have to overlook them, there were a lot of those in that episode.
Oh, sure.
But
yeah.
It's still...
It's fun, though. It is fun. If you're going to watch season two, I think that's where you have to go. A lot of people like Testament of Arcadia in season one.
Yeah.
It's kind of the... people look back and say that it was the last episode of season one where the couple go down and become new... There was a new Adam, new Eve, but that wasn't it, but that might as well have been it, right?
Right. And that... kind of showed, I mean, that if this series had ended with that episode, you would have thought almost that was the purpose of the moon blasting in orbit and going there so that they could repopulate.
Restart this planet. Yeah. Absolutely. A lot of Battlestar Galactica vibe to that in a way.
Well, they took it from Space 1999, though.
Okay, there you go. Well, I didn't mean the other way around.
No, I know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Worst. The one with the rocks. All the glistens, is that what it's called?
Glisters. I'm not sure why they spelled it that.
Yeah.
With the geologist with the cowboy hat.
Season two. Yeah. Well, the one that always trips me up is the seance spectacle thing.
Oh, yeah.
That one, I mean, I don't even remember enough of that one to even criticize it. I just remember, I'm like, whatever, moving on, you know, so...
Just the bad guy character, the guy who goes nuts in that episode, it's like you're just waiting for him to die, you know, so, because he's just very annoying.
Let me interject here for just a second, because here's... Now, you're doing something separate, so you can ignore what I'm going to say, but for years I've always thought that where they needed to go with the show, especially with the first season, was that... Koenig was having to basically make himself a dictator, a benign one,
right.
But a dictator. And I always, when I was a kid, wanted to see that maybe Gorski had stayed on the base and starts rallying people against Koenig, and you have a civil war. I really wanted to see like a moon-based civil war between the American side and the Russian side, with Koenig versus Gorski, and Gorski be undercutting Koenig's authority and everything, and see who takes which side. You know, have a
that's a cool idea. I mean, it's
next one. It's activated.
It's Yeah, my only problem with that is reconciling Gorski not leaving.
Right. You know, well, you could do somebody else. But
yeah, exactly.
Or, I mean, see, I thought Simmons could have done that, too. And
yeah, Simmons is so underused. Yeah. You know, we're planning on doing some flashback stories that take place before he disappears, mm-hmm. you know.
But basically, he sticks around for at the end of Breakaway.
It's the same room. This one. You're in the right rhythm. It's just after this one.
Commissioner Simmons, we're talking about, for those who don't remember, the bearded guy who later shows up on Babylon 5 as a commissioner, too, oddly.
I didn't realize he was on Babylon 5.
He was the Earth Alliance guy that's there to make peace with the Centauri and the Narn and everything, and it'll be great, and we'll peace in our time. He's okay. Chamberlain.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Well, he's at the end of Breakaway, he's still there. He doesn't go back to Earth, and he gets stuck on the moon, and you don't see him for like 5 episodes. And then he pops up again on Earthbound, which is another good one, by the way, the Christopher Lee one.
Continuity-wise, it sort of makes sense if you ignore the order that they produced them in or the order that they showed up on TV. It kind of makes more sense if you have Breakaway and then you have Earthbound.
Earthbound right then, yeah.
And then right after that, you go to Black Sun, because once they go through the Black Sun, they're on a different side of the galaxy, and then you can start encountering all these weird planets.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you're too close to Earth at that point.
Yeah.
But, there's no matter what, there's a period of time there where Simmons was there. Mm-hmm. I think E.C. Tubb, in his novel, he had him die in Breakaway from a head wound. Then when E.C. Tubb actually wrote the adaptation of Earthbound,
mm-hmm.
because he didn't know Simmons was coming back, he said that Simmons had actually gone into a coma from the head wound and just had woken up in time for that episode. They tried to cover it up that way.
Well, you get the sense that he had just woken up in time for that episode, because you never see him up until then, right? So, all right, any other...
Well, one of the things you were saying before about them being reactive instead of proactive,
right.
You're in this disaster situation. You cannot control where the moon is going. All you can do is be reactive, and you can try to be proactive in your reactiveness, which is one of the things that Black Sun is. They put together a team of people to survive. We have to have survivors, send people out. We have to do the shield so everybody doesn't feel like we're, you know, just committing suicide. You know, and that is what can make Space 1999 unique, instead of just being another Star Trek. Looking at we're thrust into the situation where we have to fight to survive, and what can we do to make sure we have the least amount of casualties until some kind of help comes, instead of the helicopter coming to pull you off the life raft in the middle of the ocean. It is the mysterious unknown force who steps in and helps you out at the end.
Well, you know, that raises a point, too, that I've discussed with people before, which is that in Space 1999, humans are basically at the lowest pecking order end of the universe, right? Everybody they encounter has a British accent, but everybody they encounter, they get this message, people of Alpha, right? But not only that, they're always above them in the cosmic power scale, have fleets of starships and do all this stuff, right? Even war games where you think, you know, the people that they're confronting either have no weapons or, they have the same ones we do, oddly, you find out, no, they're just way more advanced and we're messing with our minds, right? So everybody they meet is above them. And there's a real argument, I think, a debate to be made. Do we more enjoy science fiction where humans are at the bottom and have to kind of it's Koenig's nobility, right? It's Koenig and Bergman and their nobility, their stubborn determination to survive impresses the higher powers, versus where humans, kind of like in Star Trek, have all these magical technologies, and then it becomes more, how do we go down the prime directive, don't interfere with the under... There's no prime directive on Space 1999 because they never met a civilization that was lower than them. Right? Except maybe the trees. But even the trees were messing with them.
Yeah.
Even the trees were like, humans, I am Groot. So what do you think about that in terms of this versus this?
Well, I mean, what do you want to? What's a more interesting story? Like, you know, when it comes down to when we're at the top of the chain or when we're fighting for our lives, what's more interesting? You know, in and of itself, it seems like with all the many iterations of Star Trek, I'm not a big Voyager fan. After a while, it
Voyager,
just,
Space 1999, and Star Trek.
Yeah, and that's why I'm not a big Voyager fan. because it doesn't address any of these problems. They're still like, well, we have, it's going to take us 77 years to get home, but we're going to stop and look at this because we're explorers. It's like, no, you want to go home. If there's no food in that system or there's no dilithium crystals, then get the hell out.
Put the pedal to the metal and let's go.
You know, and the first scene of Space 99 was very interested in, you know, survival and what do we have to do to get out of this? And to me, that there's more. You said Koenig is a dictator, right?
Well, I said
should be.
He's having to become a benign dictator due to their circumstances.
Right, but he doesn't become an evil dictator.
No.
And to me, that shows a lot about this person, that even when he has all this power, he keeps himself from becoming that. And while other people may interpret him differently, mm-hmm. you know, it tells you a totally different side of the human condition. And, you know, contrary to what people thought back then, all sci-fi should not be Star Trek. we should be learning different things. All sci-fi should tell you about the human condition some way.
Right.
You know, even if it's science fantasy like Star Wars, obviously it tells you, you know, about believing in yourself and the forces, all that stuff. So this, again, it's the human condition. So it's not just ray guns and spaceships. And to me, that's what makes Space 1999 refreshing, the fact that it shows you a different side. And in season two, it doesn't show you a different side.
That's true. I guess the question is, can it survive on television? Could something like that survive if it's... I mean, maybe the audience wants to feel like, yeah, look at humans, we're kicking ass, as opposed to, oh, cosmic Galactus beings, don't eat us, you know. I mean, but you know, it makes me think, we're talking about the Black Sun. Could it be that this is getting deep geeking. Could it be that the mysterious unknown force wanted to see if humans would not give up and would build the force field
right.
and make an effort, as opposed to just meekly accepting our fate, because then we wouldn't be worthy of the muffing.
And whatever purpose that it has for them, when they get to wherever they're going, yeah. where the moon is taking them, can they accomplish that task? Let me throw this in front of them and see how they react. Will they do whatever it takes to get out of it?
They're the tribes of Israel going through the tests in the desert to get to the promised land. Interestingly.
Yeah.
Now it is Battlestar Galactica again. Oh my gosh! And they and finally the moon, after all these years, reaches the 13th colony, and they're back home.
Yeah.
That was confusing. Okay.
Sorry. not to get too dark with it, but. You know, if you want to draw, if you want to look at, say, 9/11, mm-hmm. the people on the plane who decided, you know, we're going to storm the cockpit.
Right.
We're going to take as much control as we can in a situation where we have no control. That the fact that though they were regular, ordinary people who were brave enough to do this, you know, Koenig, you know, and his people, they're not Marines. They're not soldiers. They're scientists that are out here, and they're stuck in this situation. They're doing their best to make the best of it. And you can get some serious, serious human stories out of that.
That's why my guy's in the Marines. Did you have a question, sir, a minute ago?
Just about some of the reproduction art that was leaked for the new theoretical reboot. Any idea who did that?
I have no idea who did it.
No.
Yeah. Sorry.
Was it significantly reimagined? I'm trying to think if I've seen this.
Eagles have a slightly different look.
Yeah.
They look more bug-like.
Yeah, it looks like somebody Battlestar Galactica, the Eagles.
Right, so. Yeah. That's what I would have expected, right? I mean, yeah. They're going to try and slick it up a little bit for CGI and everything.
Well, at the sci-fi convention, sci-fi convention, at the Space 1999 convention, he did say, I wish I could remember his name. Whatever the guy who's producing it,
Jay,
that sounds right. Okay, so yeah, he said that they decided they were definitely going to put the original Eagle in as well because they realized that it's what everybody loves.
Well, they had the old Vipers and the new Vipers in Galactica,
yeah.
So maybe they can kind of fudge it that way, I guess.
Yeah. The major difference is that I noticed from the concept art is that instead of having the windows cut into the front, there were like bulbous windows.
Oh, right, yeah. I do remember that now. I always wanted them to find a way to have some Hawks. I mean, if Hawks are human ships, why didn't they have a couple on the base? That would have been awesome. I mean, I realize that in season one, that would have defeated the whole purpose that they're not out conquering anything. But on the other hand, season two, they'd have been all over some Hawks, man.
That would have been
a go-to vehicle, wouldn't it, in season two?
In these old comics from the 70s, they didn't know. They were given pictures of the Hawks, and they didn't know that they didn't have them on Moonbase.
Oh.
So a lot of the comics are like, you know, let's use the Hawks.
Well, so, yeah, the Hawks are cool.
So basically, they had parts for Hawks. I said they had parts for Hawks in their hangar bays, you know, ones that were under construction or repair or whatever, and they didn't have the power units for them.
Oh.
And it took Victor a couple of years to figure out how to adapt the Eagles' power units to the Hawks.
Oh,
so they wind up with a flight of 12 Hawks that get destroyed before season two.
I was with you until that last little bit. Dang it.
Continuity.
They got to make more. Got to build more. I always just say they would go through the Eagles like they had a box full of parts ready to slap a new one together, you know. At least one got destroyed every episode.
Catacombs,
I'm like, they'll make more, it's fine.
The Catacombs website has a list of how many were destroyed in each episode and everything. And if you start out with 50 Eagles, they're okay.
They still got enough to get Operation Exodus to work.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I can just imagine they finally do Operation Exodus and Cody's like, well, only 12 people can leave because, you know, I've crashed like 15 myself, you know, and, you know, Alan, he got drunk that one time, and oh, Lord, so.
The good thing is that the ones that crash on the moon, and there are a few, you can assume that they salvaged
them back, yeah, get them back together again, that's right, so. Okay, let's see, we've got about 7 more minutes. Any more? Yes, sir.
So you said your graphic novels are on hold with the 2099?
Yeah, the first two were released. I have them at my table in.
You want to make sure you mention that. Yeah, you have them with you in the comic art.
So anybody who wants to come by, I have the books available for sale. But I don't know. I don't know how long this hiatus is going to be before we can continue. But the first two books are out.
So the second one is both some remastered, reworked classic stuff and new material, or is it all just the old material, or just been redone?
A lot of the stories, well, some of the stories that Charlton put out, they didn't publish the endings for the stories. They just ended it. Like, there's this
one. That sounds familiar.
There's this one where there's doppelgangers on Moonbase Alpha, and Koenig realizes that one of them is pretending to be Helena, and he rushes in to stop the one that he thinks is the alien being Helena. But it actually is Helena, and she kicks his gun out of his hand, and then they laugh about it, and it ends, but they never did anything about the doppelganger still loose. We had hired artists to mimic the style and finish those stories up and things like that. So there is new material, new connecting material in here, and stuff like that. But the core of this whole thing is those old stories, but woven into a continuity that makes the equivalent of season 1.5.
Right. Okay. Cool. It's in the Hyatt. It's in the Hyatt. Yeah, it's in the Hyatt on one of the
lower level.
Lower level. Hyatt.
Where the art thing used to be, where you used to fly in back about 6-7 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, I think where the art show was also down there.
It's right next to Hanover and Embassy, I believe.
Yeah. Is it the escalators down in the Hyatt? When you get into the, it's the bottom level.
Yeah.
In the Grand Hall West.
Yeah, right next to Hanover. Hanover's where the comics programming is, and the comics artists and writers are in the big hall next to it.
When you go into the room where all the artists are set up, if you hang a right, and I'm at the front of the second aisle.
Miss you. Yeah, I just walked right up there. Any other last couple of questions?
I wonder if anyone else has had this experience. I read the novels way before I got to see the TV show.
Hmm.
So
the novelizations of the show. Oh. Yeah, they did like
it was
two episodes
of
book.
When I saw the show, because it seemed so more coherent within the novels than when you're watching the TV show.
That's not surprising, actually, because they were able to kind of, the writer could fix things.
You know, there was like photos in the novels and stuff, so that, you know, the great scenic design and stuff, so you have like, oh, these eagles are really cool. And then when you finally get to see them, you go, well, they're still cool, but wow, this acting is terrible.
The imagination is always so much better than reality, right? Yeah. Yeah, they put out double novels where they would take two episodes of the show and kind of blend them together sometimes. Because I remember I had a second season one where part of the story was the one where Tony and Koenig are space warp. They're trapped on the other side of a space warp, and they find an alien ship to get back, you know.
Right.
And I think the other half of that one was the Beta Cloud or something, because that explained how Tony wasn't... Well, actually, he was a bit... They needed Maya to do stuff and not have Koenig around, and Koenig do stuff and not have Maya around, so they kind of split them out, you know. So
yeah, no, those novels are great, and especially the ones that E.C. Tubb wrote. He gave a lot of heart to the characters. He created a fiance for Koenig, Marcia from Aftershock and Awe.
Yes.
She's from the E.C. Tubb novels. Novel. Yeah. That had left him just before he went to the moon base. And she becomes one of the central characters in my first graphic novel. But he did some great stuff with that.
I think they also made the point that they had an artificial gravity technology, and that's what shielded them from the moon, broke from orbit. And, I mean, they kind of almost had a coherent reason why they would have just been squished with jelly.
Right.
You know,
yeah, there's so many different explanations that different writers put in different ways. I mean, like, you've done it too, right? You've come up with kind of ways of explaining.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things I enjoyed about reading these novels when I was a kid, not just Space 1999, but any of them for a sci-fi series. It's like, because the authors were generally speaking, they were better writers than the ones that were working on the shows.
Yeah.
Or they were talking about things that were just... TV audiences don't want to see that. We don't care about that. You know, that's what the producers would say.
Right.
So they would make up good reasons why these things happened.
Yeah, Blish did the Star Trek
novel.
They put, like, what, three or four episodes in every book, and then...
And Alan Dean Foster with the animated series. Those are great.
The log, Star Trek log books, that's right.
I actually read those before I knew that they were animated episodes. I didn't know. I just thought they were original
more
Star Trek.
More Star Trek, heck yeah. That's right. All right, last question. One last question? Yes, in the back. You were up first, Black.
Yeah, the same time the show was going on in 1999, another station up in Philadelphia was showing a British show called UFO. And
yep.
I always associated those two together.
They were.
Space 1999 was originally supposed to be a sequel show to UFO, but they couldn't get... After UFO was canceled, they couldn't get the funding to do a sequel show to a show that was canceled, so they revamped it into its own program.
This is all Jerry Anderson and Sylvia Anderson.
Yeah.
And the big thing about those shows was that they had actual human actors, because everything they had done up to that point, like Thunderbirds, was super marionation. So, Jerry Anderson had actual human beings walking around. It was crazy. It was amazing. Imagine if Space 1999 had been super marionation.
Weird.
Wow. It looked like World Police.
Maya would have transformed and there would have been a real cat sitting.
Yeah, what a real cat. Awesome. Giant cat with a little marionette. That's right. All right, well, on that note, it's 11 o'clock, and so we are wrapping up Space 1999. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks for
having me. Thank you. Don't forget, we're going to immediately roll into our 15th anniversary Crusade mini panel in about 2 minutes, so hang around if you want. And that's the panel. Unfortunately, I was not able to record the 15-minute Crusade mini-panel. You had to have been at Dragon Con to hear that, and a very small number of people actually were stuck around to hear it. So I'd like to thank Joe Crow and Gary Mitchell, the co-heads of the American Science Fiction Classics track, for asking me onto the Space 1999 panel, as well as Andrew Gaska, who they also asked on. The two of us together had a good time, I think, as you could tell there, talking about it. And so that's just the first of several panels from Dragon Con 2014. So tune in next time for the next installment as we dig around in the vault of what I brought back from Atlanta this year. Thanks a bunch, and now the rocket's going to get on out of here for another episode. See you down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.